This installment of the ConcertCast is sponsored by the Post-Carbon Institute, the world's leading think tank dedicated to getting society off fossil fuels fast. PCI is proud to have James Howard Kunstler as a valued advisor. The Institute's latest publication, authored by Richard Heinberg, is The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. Learn more at postcarbon.org. Hey everyone, it's Duncan Crary. You're listening to The ConcertCast, a weekly conversation about the tragic comedy of suburban sprawl featuring James Howard Kunstler. Jim is the author of The Long Emergency, The Geography of Nowhere, and The World Made by Hand novels. On today's show, we're going to be playing the conclusion to Jim's interview with Richard Heinberg, author of The End of Growth. For those of you who are interested, you can purchase a transcript of this entire podcast either as a PDF download, or you can find it at the Amazon Kindle store. Both of those cost $1. For more information, visit ConcertCast.com. And if you'd like a free audiobook version of Richard Heinberg's earlier book, Peak Everything, visit audiblepodcast.com/Kunstler.
Richard, I want to move this discussion about 13 degrees in another direction.
Sure.
We talk a lot about cities and urbanism and how we inhabit the terrain on this podcast, partly because I've written a bunch of books about it and I'm interested in it. Where do you think we're going with the way we've disposed ourselves in the landscape in terms of living in cities, living in towns, living in smaller cities? How is that stuff going to resolve in your view of things?
Well, you know, you've done so much more work on that than I have. I almost find myself echoing you when I talk about these subjects. But, you know, I certainly agree with you that we've created an infrastructure, an urban infrastructure that is designed for an energy environment that is on its last legs. The typical suburban environment, and this pains me personally because where I live in Northern California is a perfect example of that. We used to have here in Sonoma County, a county of about 500,000 people, we used to have electric rail connecting all of our towns.
Wow.
And that was in the early 20th century when the population was much smaller, probably on the order of 40,000 people in the entire county. Of course, all of that was taken up, and now most of those rail right-of-ways have been turned into bike paths. Well, bike paths are a great thing, but you know, if you want to get from Santa Rosa to Sebastopol to Occidental to Healdsburg to Petaluma, you're not going to do it on a bicycle unless that's all you have.
It's a heroic task.
It's a heroic task, yeah. So, and meanwhile, we've built out shopping malls and suburban wastelands that are just going to be unnavigable without all the SUVs and cars.
What do you think is the destiny of the suburban stuff that's out there?
Well, you know, I think we'll use what we have how we can. People will use their cars as long as they possibly can by sharing them and rideshare and car share networks, hitchhiking probably. But that's going to be increasingly difficult. People will be plowing up their suburban front lawns and putting in, tomato beds and planting potatoes. It's hard to say how far that will get us. During the 1940s with the Victory Gardens, we could grow 40% of our fruit and vegetables. But we're talking about a lot of people who, for whom the 1940s is a long way in the past, and they have no real cultural memory of that, and the only thing they know how to grow is a lawn.
Yeah, I personally don't expect Americans to grow all their food, or perhaps even most of their food. But we are going to have to grow a lot of food closer to home, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, and we're going to have to start paying proportionally more for food because the cheap food that we've been enjoying for the past few decades is, somebody else is actually paying for that production in environmental terms and in labor terms. We've lost most of our farmers because they couldn't compete with the fuel-fed tractors and combines. But as fuel gets more expensive, I mean, the equation is absolutely inescapable. As fuel becomes more expensive, we will have to replace fuel-fed machines with human labor. There's no getting away from it.
Richard, I wrote a couple of novels that depicted the post-petroleum American future. And so I've laid out kind of a vivid picture of my own idea of how we're going to be living in the future. Do you have a picture of your own?
Well, you know, in my darker moments, I think of the road.
That's pretty severe now.
That's pretty severe. And I know we can do much better than that. You know, somewhere there's a spectrum between the road on one end and sort of the ideal transition town on the other, where everybody is just out, you know, in community gardens all day.
The Ectopia? And, what was that place?
Ecotopia.
Ecotopia.
Yeah, what we're in for, I think, is a lot of variations on those two themes, mostly somewhere in the middle. But it's going to look very different in different places, depending on what people have to work with, the weather, the culture, and so on.
Does it ever trouble your mind that you sort of kick back and think, oh my gosh, Southern California is down there. What will happen to it?
Yeah, well, of course. And some of these places are tragedies waiting to happen. And Southern California is certainly on that list, not only because of peak oil, but because of climate change and the potential for a big earthquake. There are just a lot of things that are almost inevitably going to go wrong with a place like that. I could also think of Phoenix, Arizona, some of the big cities in Texas. And
let's not leave out Las Vegas.
Yes, by all means, let's not.
Which, by the way, most people, you know, in the 1990s and a little after that, considered to be the city of the future. You know, and the place with the best prospects in America, I think, to illustrate how insane we probably are.
Yeah, right. Well, let's see what's going on in Las Vegas right now. I mean, the property values there have plummeted further than any other city in the country. Why is that? Well, I mean, all of the things we've been talking about, the insane suburban infrastructure, the reliance on the assumption that money is what life is about rather than natural resources and human labor and community.
I can't even imagine that the great wad of American middle-class people who have been going there for the last 30, 40 years will have any surplus money to throw down the bunny hole of gambling, you know, after a certain point. It's just inconceivable to me. These are people who can't even feed their families.
Yeah, I know. Over the short term, you know, tragically, people who perceive themselves as being down on their luck sometimes double down.
And, well, you're right.
Yeah, gambling is an addiction, and people will be doing it. But, you know, increasingly, people just won't be able to afford to get there.
I think you're right. And I also have a lot of, well, I guess they're fantasies because I'm projecting myself into the future. But I have a lot of thoughts that the commercial aviation industry is not going to be doing very well. I can't imagine how they keep it going.
Yeah, well, they've remained profitable by downsizing, by...
They've fired everybody they can possibly fire.
They've fired people, and they've taken out routes and
consolidated.
They've grounded planes. They've made sure that every plane is absolutely full or as full as it possibly can be. So even with high fuel prices, they've remained profitable up to this point. But you know, once you make a system as efficient as it can possibly be, that also makes it increasingly brittle. So I think the airlines are at the breaking point now.
Well, you've raised a very interesting question that Nassim Nicholas Taleb touches upon constantly because it's at the heart of his work, which is that systems that don't have redundancy and don't have a lot of pathways for things to go around tend to be extremely fragile. And
right.
It seems we've succeeded in making our systems as fragile as possible.
Yeah, well, in the name of economic efficiency.
Exactly. A very misleading economic concept and argument, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, if we can grow corn cheaper in Iowa than any place else, then we should grow all of our corn in Iowa and nothing in Iowa except corn. But then if the Iowa corn crop fails, we have no corn. But, that's the principle we've been depending on. And it has been part of the growth engine. It has yielded GDP growth, this single-minded pursuit of economic efficiency. But then, of course, we pay for it later on as the brittle systems that we've created start to break down.
Yeah, I have said more than once in my own books, we don't seem to have a sense of consequence in our culture anymore.
Yeah.
There's another term that I'm playing with these days. It has different incarnations. Maybe you have a thing to say about it, because it affects how we think and how we act about the problems that we face. Sometimes I refer to it as techno-triumphalism. Sometimes,
that's a great phrase.
Sometimes techno-grandiosity. My latest favorite incarnation is techno-narcissism. Do you think we're techno-narcissists?
I think that's a great phrase. I mean, you know, what is everyone fixated on these days? It's their iPads and iPhones. And we want to believe that because there's a new version of the iPad or iPhone coming out every year, that therefore there's a technological solution for everything. There's got to be an app for that, you know. If we need a new energy source, maybe somebody will come out with an energy app that will, you know, solve all our problems.
Is there an app for paying your debt?
Yeah, right, exactly. The tendency to extrapolate the progress and change we see just in these fields of communication and computing, the tendency to want to extrapolate that to all the other problems of society, climate change, energy, agriculture, and food, is really irrational, because all of these other fields are ones that are very slow to evolve. And we haven't seen, you know, profound technological change or rapid technological change in these other fields. We're still driving automobiles. You know, we're still growing corn with tractors and pesticides and herbicides that are maybe a little different from what we were using 20 years ago, but not that different.
Yeah, there's an argument that basically after a certain point, all you really get are refinements of basic innovations. And
right.
We seem to be sort of at that point.
Yeah, I mean, what do we use technology for? We use it for transporting ourselves, communicating, making stuff. And these are things we've been doing for hundreds or thousands of years. What modern technology has enabled us to do is to increase the speed with which we do these things and the scale. But you can't increase those factors forever. And we've gotten pretty close to the point where we can do things as quickly as we'll ever be able to do them. So there's vanishingly little progress left to be had in many areas in technology.
Well, Richard, to wrap things up, I'm going to ask you a question that university audiences ask me all the time and annoys me no end, but I'm going to ask it of you.
Okay.
What is your time frame for how the dust settles on all these issues and where it will leave us?
Well, I wish I could say that, you know, we have 10 years to prepare. And when I started writing about these issues back in the early 2000s, you know, that's what we could say. We were looking at peak oil, you know, happening around the year 2010. Turns out we weren't far off, because oil production has been pretty much stagnant since 2005. Today, you know, I think we are in the midst of a profound economic transformation that is highly unpredictable, highly unstable, highly volatile. We literally could see a 2008 economic event later this year, as soon as, where are we now? August. We could see something in September, October. It's that volatile situation. At the same time, I prefer pessimism to panic. I think we should keep a generally pessimistic attitude. Anybody who isn't pessimistic right now isn't paying attention.
Can you be pessimistic and cheerful at the same time?
Yeah, you can be pessimistic but cheerful, and I think, you know, you are a great example of that.
Well, Richard,
Speaking of pessimism, there's another label that is applied to writers like you and Jim and Dmitry Orlov, which is the term doomer. And I would like to know what your thoughts are on that term. Do you identify as a doomer? Do you reject the label?
Yeah, I reject the label of doomer. And, you know, if you read my writings and compare them with those of some of the people who post on, let's say, the Oil Drum, there are some real doomers out there who say that humanity has no chance and that we're doomed to extinction and so on. Well, yeah, I mean, Homo sapiens will go extinct at some point. It's impossible to say when, but every species sooner or later goes extinct. But, you know, we are also incredibly adaptable, and we have been through really hard times before. I don't doubt that what we have in front of us is the biggest challenge ever faced by any generation of human beings in all of our history. But at the same time, you know, we are an amazingly creative bunch. And I actually kind of look forward to seeing how we adjust to the challenges ahead.
Me too. And Richard, you and I are both fiddle players, although you're a much better one than I am.
Oh, well.
I'm going to tell you what I've been learning this week, and then I want you to tell me what you've been playing lately. I'm learning that English country dance tune called Well Hall. Very beautiful, simple tune. What are you playing lately?
Oh, gosh. Well, tonight I'm actually getting together with some friends of mine. We have a little impromptu string quartet, and we're going to be playing Beethoven Opus 18 Number 4 and the Brahms First String Quartet.
I maintain that music will save us, Richard.
Well, it's what keeps me going, I have to say. I spend at least 90 minutes every day in front of the music rack. And to the extent that I am sane, I think I have music to thank for it.
Well, you're setting a heroic example. It's been a great conversation, and I want to thank you for coming on the podcast.
It's been a real pleasure, Jim.
We'll do it again.
Thanks, Richard.
Good luck with the book, Richard.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Kunstler Cast featuring James Howard Kunstler. To leave a listener comment, call toll-free at 866-924-9499. Send email to letters@kunstlercast.com. You can listen to all of our past programs, join our email list, find out how to book Jim to speak in your area, and talk about the show with other listeners at kunstlercast.com. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.